Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And brought to you by you. Thank you to our beautiful and fantastic patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UKtech. Obviously, if you are one of our patrons, you are getting our extended ad-free version of this week's show. And if you're not, but would like to get our ad-free versions, our extended longer versions, our live streaming, which is going on right now, and hello to everyone listening live in our Discord chat room, you can start all that off by going to patreon.com/UKtech and find out how you can support us with no commitment. And that's key. You can try it, and if you don't like it, you can just cancel, and we'll be very grateful for you giving us a shot. Thank you to Will Dawson and Martin Gear, who have joined us most recently. Fantastic to have you guys on board. And later on, everybody, later on, we're going to talk about something we have never talked about on the podcast before, ever. That's the Nate Langson promise right there. Let's begin with British Airways. It's finally, Ian, finally getting onboard Wi-Fi. But here's a funny thing. Can you guess, guess without looking at the running order, how many planes are getting Wi-Fi?
Okay, four.
Oh, very close, mate. Very close. Three.
Apparently, what, really?
Yes, three, according to Engadget this week. The company did say the number will rise to 118 planes over the next 2 years. But last year, in fact, last April, it said customers in all cabins would shortly have access to Wi-Fi on long-haul flights. And then connectivity would be added to the short-haul ones, you know, domestic stuff, later that year. Although BA did say to Engadget that the latter, short-haul stuff, will come later this year now. However,
I'm sure no one's particularly bothered about short-haul. Like, we could all live without it on a trip to Amsterdam. It's it's transatlantic and further that we need Wi-Fi.
I completely disagree. Think about how annoying it would be to remove Wi-Fi from the London Tube now.
I find the London Tube Wi-Fi very annoying anyway, because it doesn't work in the trains.
Yet. We've talked about that. They're extending it.
I know, sure, and I'm sure it's only a matter of time. But the point is that, yes, I would miss it, but I can live without it because it's stations only. And I find that whole process very frustrating. In fact, I'd find it more relaxing, because what I tend to do is wait for the tube doors to open, frantically try and get it back on the Wi-Fi, and then do whatever I've got to do, and then it's shut again. And so actually, unless it's in the tubes, I'd almost rather get rid of the thing.
Well, it will be in the large tubes floating through the air at 35,000 feet that are getting these. And BA is going to offer two Wi-Fi tiers, too. One's called Browse, one's called Stream. And you can guess which is designed for what. The Browse one starts at £5, and that limits your usage to websites and messaging apps, social media, stuff like that. Stream has all the previous benefits, presumably, but will allow you to stream video. And they say that it will have no less than approximately 1 megabit per second. So that is enough to stream Netflix and some others, iPlayer and things like that. Although what will be interesting is where the exit IP on the plane says the plane is, because that might cause havoc with the region blocking of
I would imagine
Netflix.
That it would be routed back to BA's network and would exit from London or wherever their head office is.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you?
I believe that's probably going to be the only way to realistically do it.
But, it reminds me of the whole DVD region thing, where there's all these different region codes, but there are special region codes for things like oil rigs and submarines and even spacecraft or some bizarre thing, because like technically they're not part of any country. And it sort of strikes me that there's an opportunity to say, well, this only applies if your feet are on the ground, and if you're in the plane or in a space station or on something Elon Musk invents in 10 years time, then you're not subject to region blocking or what have you. It'd be quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, region blocking should have died a long time ago, shouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, this, so yes, the basic service starts at $4.99. That's for the browse. And the streaming service, the top tier, is £7.99. And you can start 10 minutes after takeoff, which isn't bad.
Well, I don't know why you have to wait for 10 minutes.
I don't know. It's the amount of time it takes to get into the height that the seatbelt sign generally goes off and you can turn your devices back on. Although they don't care about that anymore.
No, because you're allowed to have devices on now as long as they're small.
Yes.
I've been asked to shut my iPad in the past, but phones they don't have a problem with, and Kindles and stuff like that.
And headphones, crucially. They don't mind you having your headphones on now when you're taking off.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that makes sense. But, I mean, I sort of, in a way, I kind of think that is a bit silly, because I think people should be aware of what's going on during takeoff and landing. I think people should be sort of more expected to pay attention. I know that everyone's flown and we all know how to get out of a plane. But I don't know, there's just something about it. I kind of think, well, you know, just listen to them.
Mm. Well, Richard in the chat room says that the large noise cancelling headphones are ones they do ask you to remove. And I'll say something, I've never been asked to remove mine. I mean, since the new rules came in, generally speaking, even if it's wireless, you just plug the cable in and they don't seem to care. Richard actually also mentions that Air Canada, which presumably flies to Canada, costs $20 for Wi-Fi access during the flight. I'm hoping that one of the three planes that does have Wi-Fi is the one that Kate and I are flying to Japan on at the end of the month, because that would be delightful. Well, it'd be interesting to see people's experiences with these sorts of things, because the issue with things like latency and what have you makes real-time communication, I would have thought, quite challenging. But there's so many planes around the world now that have this. It'd be really interesting to get some real-world examples of people's experience using in-plane Wi-Fi. What do you use it for? Is it annoying? Or do you get annoyed with other people using it? Do people actually use the phone? Because that was always the fear, that people would be on the phone
the
entire time.
No, no one uses the phone that I've seen. I've used it, and it's fine. It's not a great experience, but it was, for me, it was worth the money, because it enabled me to tweet and work and stuff like that. So, you know,
fair enough. But you can let us know any experiences you have had, please, at hello@techpodcast.uk. Ian.
Yes?
It's time to talk about cows.
Oh, good. I've been looking forward to this.
Yes. It's going to be.
Since it was first mooted earlier.
I'm glad you started with the puns, because I'm going to milk these puns for all they're worth this week.
Oh, God, already.
I am indeed. According to the Irish Times, Cainthus, probably woefully mispronouncing that, but it's an Irish ag tech or agricultural tech startup, has developed facial recognition for cows. We already knew that, but it's received funding from a company called Cargill, which is one of the largest crop traders and meat producers in the world. I saw this story and instantly thought, huh? What? WTF? So I did a little bit of probing around on this. Now, and apparently, this is a really, really useful piece of technology for farmers. Because at the moment, you aren't really able to get real-time monitoring of what a cow, I don't say what is it, what's a cow feeling like, you know, milk yield and water intake, food intake, all stuff like that. But the technology here actually allows the farmer to monitor the health and well-being of livestock, and it uses images, photos, basically, of the cow, using either body patterns, like their markings, and facial recognition as well, in order to track all of this sort of stuff, including things like behavioral patterns. And then the software can deliver real-time analytics back to the farmer on a cow-by-cow basis. You know, so we talk about the Internet of Things being like machine-to-machine communication. This is, I don't even know what this counts as, C2C, cow to consumer, cow to, it's very bizarre. But it can identify individual cows by their features in apparently several seconds, and then record that animal's identity. And then, as I say, it means that what used to take days or weeks to garner useful information from can now basically be done in real time. And they've got investment and funding from a gigantic meat-producing conglomerate. I think they're US-based, actually, Cargill, but I'd have to double-check that, in order to expand. And they're going to bring the technology now to more dairy farms around the world, and that they're also going to expand into other species, including pigs and poultry and things, and maybe even fish. Now, That to me is amazing. And as soon as I heard this story, I thought, I'm going on Monday or Tuesday to pitch a video to Bloomberg to go over to Ireland and see cow facial recognition tech in action, because it just sounds utterly fantastic.
It does sound like a genuinely interesting story. And I mean, obviously, it's not surprising to me that every cow's face is unique and different, and people can, or, you know, technology can differentiate them. But the idea of it, of how they do it, is quite fascinating, actually.
Kate in the chat room is positing that spray painting numbers on cows would be too obvious as a way of identifying. I don't think that necessarily tracks. It wouldn't allow a machine to track these cows. The idea is that it's increasing the efficiency of the sort of farmyard to table strategy, if you like.
Well, you could just put a QR code on them, you know, like ink on a QR code on.
I don't think that would work. I mean, a cow is basically, well, it basically is a giant QR code, isn't it? A black and white cow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Just, okay. Just use the whole cow. I mean, I suppose that might be what they're doing. It might be essentially that exact thing. It's the patterning and whatever. But I mean, not all cows are black and white. Let's not forget. Like, a lot of cows are not, are brown, or, you know, a different colour. That's basically my cow knowledge exhausted.
Hmm. Well, they have four stomachs.
Yes, I know that.
It's an interesting point, isn't it?
And sometimes you have to stick your whole arm up the backside of one to ascertain problems. I did used to watch All Creatures Great and Small, and there wasn't a week went by where James Herriot didn't have his arm up a cow.
This isn't the first time we've seen facial recognition being used for animals, because there has been a report for Time, in fact, a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, where software had been developed to identify cats. And part of the reason for this was to innovate the cat door technology. So instead of having a cat's collar with a little magnet or RFID chip, which is how some of the more advanced cat doors can detect your cat from another cat, software now exists to track the cat on a machine learning basis, so it knows your cat's face and only lets your cat through the door. And similar has been done for cat feeders as well, so they can recognize each individual cat, distribute the right amount of food based on what that specific cat has had.
Now
that
would be really useful, because we've got two cats, as you know, and Hugo will eat all of his food and then eat all of Annie's food, and Annie, she's not so bothered. She's not a big eater anyway, but she does deserve more food than she gets. So that's a good way of, you know, like getting some facial recognition to stop that fat cat from eating his sister's food.
Ian, we're going to talk now about one of our favourite topics, broadband.
Oh God, I'm so excited.
And in fact, you know what? We can preempt this, because there is a slight mobile phone related story that we can use as a segue here, because the Scotsman reported this week that the UK government has to fix Scotland's unacceptable, that's a quote, unacceptable, mobile phone coverage. And this is according to the Federation of Small Businesses. And that's what it's planning to tell MPs next week. Essentially, it says, again, the FSB says, that 17% of Scotland's geography has 4G mobile coverage compared to 60% of England's. Now, my immediate thought was, well, Scotland has a lot more hills that makes 4G an awful lot more difficult to, you know, to penetrate, if you like. And I don't know how that could necessarily be addressed, since that a lot of those geographical areas are also sparsely populated. Whereas
that's exactly what I was going to say, because it's never those mobile phone numbers are never given on the basis of landmass. They're given on population reach, aren't they? So it might be that they reach 99% of Scotland's population. And in fact, I would say you probably far easier to get a 99% coverage rate in Scotland than you could in England.
Interesting. Well, yes, probably, actually. Richard Taylor in the chat room says that in Northern Ireland, their transmitters are on top of hills.
Well, so that makes sense.
Yeah, Yeah, so you get better signal out there than you do in towns. And certainly when I've been in Scotland, we have received 4G, but it varies wildly. And it also differs quite dramatically, you know, based obviously on what network you're on, because the networks use different frequencies of spectrum, which are sometimes better at getting around obstacles than others. But that's what the FSB is going to tell MPs next week, that more needs to be done here. However,
I'd be interested to know why they're telling the UK government that and why it's not a Scottish matter for the Scottish Parliament. But that's a very niche question, and it's not one that I mean aggressively. It's one that I'm genuinely interested in.
Yeah, no, I'm interested as well. I mean, I wonder if it's something to do with devolved parliaments not necessarily being able to assign funds in the same way, but who knows?
But presumably they could still put pressure on the mobile operators to do a better job in Scotland if it's a concern. If, you know, they should be saying to them, look, you know, you're operating up here, you've got to, you know, get some more coverage.
Yeah. If anyone in Scotland listening has knowledge or experience about this, it'd be very useful to have you write in hello@techpodcast.uk. Maybe give us a bit of local insight on what mobile networks and coverage and things is like in general up there, where you make the best whiskey in the world. However, it related to another story that we saw this week about Scotland and more broadband in general, in that Edinburgh is going to be one of the first 8 cities that Openreach is going to bring its ultra-fast internet connections to by 2020. BT still owns Openreach, right? It's just not
they're legally separate entities, but they are still the same company.
Yeah. So Openreach said this week that it promises to connect 3 million premises to ultra-fast fibre connections by 2020. And in addition to that, well, I say in addition, by ultra-fast, they're talking about increasing speeds from 24 megabits a second to 100 megabits. However, I looked at the original press release that this news came from, and Clive Selley, who's the chief, the CEO of Openreach, said, blah, 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 blah. This, working closely with central and local governments, our communications provider customers, we will identify the cities, towns and rural areas where we can build a future-proofed fibre-to-the-premises network that's capable of delivering gigabit speeds to all homes and businesses at an affordable cost. What you can read into that is that they are having to very gently roll this out in order to make sure that it remains affordable, while at the same time not offering a competitive service, perhaps, compared to what Virgin and City Fibre and others are doing. But nonetheless, the CEO still said they're going to connect 10 million customers to this ultra-fast connection of, you know, gigabit fibre-to-the-premises stuff by 2025. Ian, I know you retweeted this story on the text message account this week with some criticisms, of which I shared. Would you like to discuss said critique?
Yeah, it's not enough people, is it? I just want money to be spent on this, from the kind of money that is being wasted every day on things like High Speed 2. I think is going to be much better deployed on making it so that people don't have to go into cities to do work. I would like the situation to be where people can live wherever they feel geographically happiest. Like, for example, I don't like the sea. I've no interest in living by the sea. I find the sea to be a thoroughly irritating thing. It's grey.
Only you, mate, could be, and boring. Could be personally annoyed by water.
Very much so. I find the seaside to be an affront to my desire to be warm and not blown over by wind. The chat room is making me laugh because I'm complaining, and apparently that's a 2-drink minimum. But what I strongly feel is that, you know, as soon as we can make it so that people can live in the middle of rural Scotland and still have a job where they're working with colleagues in London, in Manchester, in, you know, in New York, I kind of feel that that's where the future is. I don't think the future is us getting on a metal box with 100 other sweaty people and feeling miserable for an hour of unproductive time while we move ourselves into a capital city. It's just ridiculous.
Yes. And also.
Yes,
I also think that if we got rid of that, people would be far less likely to have their iPads stolen going into Liverpool Street Station as well.
Exactly, and that's another thing. You know, we've all had problems with trains whereby we've lost something or gained a weird friend. But you know, a lot of people will tell you about you know, High Speed 2, which is supposed to make it easier for people in Birmingham to come to London. Now, that whole attitude is completely wrong. It's like, you know, or to make it easier for London people to go to Birmingham. It's just stupid. It's cutting a small amount of time for billions and billions of spent on infrastructure. When do people really need to go to? I mean, we don't need to be in the same room to do a podcast, do we? And I don't need to be in the same country as Forbes to write articles for them. And I'm able to, you know, understand the markets in the UK and the US to an extent that the only thing stopping me from working for an American company is just the fact that I need to understand the market over there enough to give it some context to an American audience. You know, so really, and I know that not all jobs are the same, but the majority of people do not need to be in an office in London every single day. And I think as soon as we can make it so that the whole country is on a level footing with good broadband that's mandatory, you know, the government says you must be able to provide this speed, and it should go up by a decent amount every year to, you know, to allow for new technologies and new, you know, whatever people need to do, you know, because VR is going to offer people a lot of opportunities to, you know, to physically see things. Like I could get a briefing from Apple and they could take me in VR to California and I could see the product without leaving my house. That saved countless carbon, and I'm still getting, you know, I mean, I know it's obviously not quite the same and you can't take photos of a virtual environment, but what I'm saying is I think that this is a very, you know, previous century solution to a problem, and broadband is still not fast enough for huge numbers of people. You know, we were chatting in the chat room about it, you know, people still getting ADSL version 1 speeds, you know, sub 1 megabit per second in this day and age is just not good enough, and it could be solved with a relatively modest investment.
Well, John in the chat room is saying that he can't really do his job from home, unfortunately, because he's a teacher.
Sure.
And that immediately, my first thought was, oh yeah, of course. And then my second thought was, I went to the BET education conference a couple of weeks ago, and one of the sessions that I went to sort of looked at remote schooling and how Skype and a couple of other technologies can be used to improve access to education. And one of the examples that they gave me was a way of having one country's students learn about another student's country, if you're following me,
yeah,
even if they didn't speak the same language, by talking over Skype and trying to describe their country to the other student. And Skype has this real-time translation feature in it that Microsoft Research developed and was baked into Skype, that meant you could have a group of students speaking English and a group of students speaking Spanish, and they could talk to each other as if they were speaking the same language and try and guess which country that other student or group of students was in. And I thought, when I thought that's a thing that actually exists now, that actually how long can it be that a teacher could work from home in a traditional environment? I don't mean things like Open University lecturers and some people who may do a lot of grading or online tutorials from home or run a MOOC, but an actual, you know, typical 30 kids per class secondary school. Oh, I can't make it in today because I'm snowed in. But instead, I'll project my image onto the wall, and we're gonna have the lesson exactly the same. Which, again, as you say, very fast broadband and low latency broadband would be essential for that. But
yeah.
I'm sure that's, if it's not a thing now, I bet it will be in the next 5 years.
I think, you know, that all of the stuff that worries me most about our government tends to be the fact that even with probably quite competent advisors, they still aren't getting that the future is not going to be getting on a train. And I've seen no evidence that anything can't be done. I mean, you know, traditionally schooling would be quite a challenge to do virtually, but I feel like it must be possible. And in some countries, it would make a huge difference if you could If you could say school urban Chinese children, you know, centrally or whatever, so that everyone has the same access to the same quality of education. I mean, and frankly, if in 100 years' time we're still moving kids into a building for school when they could have, you know, you could have one teacher, you could have specialists for every kind of education, and every child in the country could get the same schooling and, you know, with great results, you could pick the very best teachers and you would save huge amounts of money. If that's not happened by the time I'm shuffling off Earth, and, you know, I'll be surprised and annoyed because we're doing everything wrong.
Well, John added in the chat room actually that the school that he teaches in has a sister school in China, and they do they're planning to do the Skype chats between his school and the Chinese school. You know, he says he's done videos as well of him teaching lessons, but he says it's very labor intensive. So it feels like technology is beginning to crack that problem. But as you say, there's a lot of obstacles that need to be overcome.
Yeah. I just don't think that we should also be subsidizing something that, you know, like, I mean, trains for me seem to be one of those things that they're a money pit. And broadband, on the other hand, isn't so much. It's possible to make money from broadband. If you invest in it, then the government could get a return on that would pay it off. I don't think you'd need to invest very much. It certainly wouldn't need to be billions, probably. I mean, although it may be. But I think over the course of the next 5 years, you could completely pay that money back to the public purse if you ran it properly. So, you know, I just feel like it's one of those things that should be happening anyway. They could do both if they want. If they want to do both, if I want to do high speed 2 and broadband, but they just don't care about broadband, and I think it's much more important than they do.
Well, the for now at least, Openreach is going to be beginning the first phase of its super fast, its ultra fast broadband rollout to 8 cities later this year: Birmingham, Bristol, Cardiff, Edinburgh, Leeds, Liverpool, London, and Manchester. No surprises there. And that would form the first phase, yes, the first phase of the program, to connect 40 towns, cities, and boroughs. But maybe too little, too late, I think, is possibly the consensus there.
Yes.
Let us know any feelings you have on this, or obviously any other broadband topic. We try not to overdo the broadband stuff. I know it's become a little bit of a joke that we talk about broadband a lot, but the reason for it is that we have an incredibly competitive broadband market and media market in the UK and in Europe. And it's one of the areas where I think we've got a lot more to talk about than the US does. You know, they can talk about broadband and telecoms in the context of, you know, abusive monopolies or too little choice. We have almost the exact opposite problem, which is we generally have far too much choice. No, not too much, but you know what I mean? We have so much choice that it can be quite confusing. And there's an awful lot of developments going on very, very fast. And so we'd like to break that down for you. But if you want us to talk about broadband less, then obviously you can let us know in the email. Let's move into some email, shall we, Ian? I can feel the mailbag bulging with sort of hope and expectation and dreams. Would you like to take the first email we've had here from Tom?
Yes, I would. Hello, Nate and Ian. Your discussion about Wi-Fi calling got me thinking about visual voicemail. Why is it still not available on Vodafone? I've had a Vodafone iPhone for work without and an O2 iPhone for personal use with. Surely, after so many years, it should be available on all carriers. Thanks, Tom. Yes, it's not available on 3 either, as Richard points out in the chat. Is it still just O2?
I believe so. I mean, it definitely still isn't on Vodafone. I mean, a big part of the reason why is simply because you have to enable a lot in the back end to make it work.
It's a significant investment, isn't it? Like, it was done, O2 did it because it had to in order to get the contract to sell the iPhone exclusively. Yep. No one else had to do it. Although I'm surprised Apple didn't sort of insist on it, really, because it was a huge part of the iPhone, wasn't it?
I think the other reason for it as well is that the move away from traditional voice communications and towards over-the-top services, you know, your messaging apps and your VoIP things, they've sort of made the need, or at least the justification of the investment, kind of redundant now, which definitely wasn't the case when the iPhone first came out. But today, I mean, when was the last time you had a useful voicemail? really.
You know what, mate? I'm actually going to turn my voicemail off because it's nothing but nonsense.
Yeah, I don't think it's massively in need. But that's probably why, to answer your question, Tom. Stuart wrote in, and this is the last time we're going to talk about Wi-Fi calling because I know our original emailer, he emailed in actually and said he was very grateful for all the support the community's given, which is great. But Stuart did write in and said that just wanted to add that EE Wi-Fi calling works for the Pixel and Nexus 6P, which he and his wife uses, and he shares a link to the supported phones on EE's website. So maybe we'll include that link in the show notes. And
good idea.
Consider it a repository for all things Wi-Fi calling. But thanks to everyone for all that help and input. It's great having such a big community to draw experience and knowledge from. Kieran has written in, "Hi guys, I'd like to chime in my personal experience with Qi charging. In general, I agree with Nate's sentiment about the current state of wireless charging. It's not really much different than just using the cable and generally a worse experience. You now have a slower charge, which to be fair isn't a problem if it's overnight," he points out. "And often those pads are fairly fussy about the position of the phone. If you're not placing it close to dead center, the rate of charging drops exponentially. The one place where I have seen a good use for it is when I was at a Starbucks in San Francisco, and each seat has a Qi pad. Casually charging my device without hunting for a plug point was pretty nice," he says. "Where I am optimistic on the tech is if they can scale it to the point where a large mat or pad can be used to charge several devices simultaneously. When that becomes available and affordable, then I'd see that as a marked improvement over the current wired method. As a recent expat, you guys, one of the ways I use to keep track of what's going on back in the UK. So very appreciative of what you guys do." Well, thank you very much, Kieran. It's great to have you as a listener. And actually, the whole multiple device charging thing, that's something Apple's bringing out, I believe, right?
Yes. Where is it, though? Where is this flipping charger?
I'm not sure, because at the moment they're still pushing the third-party ones, the Belkin ones.
Yeah.
But the one that they have announced and certainly is due to come out can charge up to three devices. You know, the idea being that it's an iPhone and an Apple Watch at the same time. I think it's three devices, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's the AirPods, Watch, and the phone. I would really like that, because the Apple Watch isn't widely supported. Apparently, you can get that to charge on some wireless charging pads. But the iPhone charges flawlessly on all of my wireless charging devices, including a really old one from a company called Tilt that I got sent years ago that never really worked brilliantly with Samsung's and LG phones. It was always kind of really hit and miss whether you could actually get it on, you know, the charging thing and get it to work. But actually on the iPhone, it works flawlessly. And the iPhone works flawlessly on both of my Samsung Puck chargers as well, which are wireless. And it's just, I've written about this before, but the way that Apple's implemented it is just somehow better. I don't know how. I'm sure people are just going to call me a massive fanboy. But you have to work a lot less hard to get an iPhone to lock its charge. Maybe it's still a victim of that slow charging thing and they just don't tell you. But it's a lot more keen to pick up a charger than any of my Android phones are.
Yeah, I mean, I've found that the iPhone X does charge very slowly on the wireless charging pad, but it doesn't seem as fussy as to the exact placement. But it's still slow enough that I haven't used it since doing the review.
Mine's on my desk. So what I do is because I used to just use a wooden IKEA phone stand. But now what I do is I just put it on the charging dock, whatever it's got down to during my walk to take the kids to school or whatever, I put it on my desk when I get back, and it starts charging, and then it's ready to go when I need to go, and I pick it up and it's charged. It's a lot easier. And then I've got one by the bed. I put it on the thing, and then it's got all night to charge. I don't care if it's quick or not. It's absolutely fine. Works brilliantly. So, you know, for me, it's ideal, and it means I don't have to faff around with cables.
A Macworld report suggested that the Apple's AirPower pad will launch maybe Q1 of this year, so by March or April possibly.
Yeah.
But it's still not out, and a leak has suggested that it might cost as much as £200.
If that's the cost, then that's a big mistake.
Yeah, I mean, that is an awful lot of money to very slowly charge your device all through.
Well, it won't be slow. It will be fast. I think that it's because they've upped the wattage it can do now, haven't they, to fast charging, because there was an iOS update that enabled it, wasn't there?
There was. Well, Stephen in the chat room has asked if anyone's ordered a HomePod. The answer is no. However, I am picking one up on Tuesday, and I did go in to see Apple last week and got to hear one. In fact, I got to hear two side by side in the paired configuration that isn't available at launch for some bizarre reason. So maybe
given the amount of delays they've been getting this thing out, you would have thought they'd have cracked that by now. But
yeah, I mean, so I'll give you a brief summary if for those of you who are interested. It does sound very, very, very good. Yeah, I'll give them that. It sounds, I've compared it to an Amazon Echo, what else was there? A Google Home, I think, and a couple of others. And it's definitely, hands down, the best sounding of any of those devices, categorically. However, to me, the killer feature is having it in a paired configuration. So having two of them, I've heard it play a piece of music with two together, and it sounds insanely good, like really, really good, to the level that it wouldn't surprise me if some people won't buy bookshelf speakers and instead use this. It's that impressive.
I've heard that the way they do the room mapping is very, very clever, and it sounds very good as a result.
It does. It sounds very, very good. You wouldn't replace a hi-fi with one of them, but I could definitely see some people who are maybe not like crazy hi-fi nuts but do like good sound and do like design. I could see those sorts of people replacing a hi-fi and bookshelf speakers with these. It's expensive, but it sounds fantastic. The problem with it, though, is that the HomePod has very limited kind of automation features, if you like, compared to something like the Amazon Echo and the Google Home. You know, it was only able to stream news from Sky, BBC and LBC, and I said why can't I add more, and Apple said that part of the reason is that those stations, actually, it's not that you're streaming their radio show, they're producing custom produced news summaries every half an hour or so that can be streamed via the HomePod. So it's a bespoke streaming news system that
presumably it's also the same one that they use for Sky News Break on Amazon Alexa and other like-minded devices.
Absolutely, yeah. Sorry, I'm not implying it's bespoke for Apple.
No, but it's a good way of explaining. If you see it on Amazon, then it's very likely it'll eventually be on the HomePod.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, it's very much locked down to an Apple device. You know, you can't use it with anything else unless you have at least one iOS device to set it up. Then you can use AirPlay to stream to it. That's very, very limited. It is expensive. It's £350. In my experience using it, I definitely think it sounds great, and I think it's got potential. But I wouldn't buy one for £350. And even though it sounds amazing with two of them, I certainly wouldn't buy two at £700 to get that yet. I think it needs, in my limited experience with it so far, very good sounding. But I think the version 2 with more Siri integration, I think will be more impressive. And I think it's one of these things where it depends what you're buying it for. If you're buying it because you live in the Apple ecosystem, you want a really great sounding speaker, and you're not actually that bothered about Siri too much, then it's actually probably quite a good product to buy. It's certainly something that I could see being used in bedrooms and kitchens. And when I actually questioned Apple about the whole limited functionality of Siri, they said that, you know, they look at what most people use Siri for, and it's things like setting timers, checking weather, train times, setting reminders and alarms, playing some music, doing voice calls and stuff on speakerphone. They're all the things that the HomePod can do, because apparently that's what the majority of people are using Siri for. So they've sort of said, let's just take that giant percentage, make sure it does those things, and all the other nuanced stuff and specific stuff, we can maybe leave out, but build in Siri Kit, the whole API framework for people to bake HomePod into apps. So it's in the hands of developers to a certain extent. But this is all based on about, you know, an hour with the device under Apple's sort of demonstration, if you like, in their offices. So take all that with a pinch of salt. I'm getting one this week, and I'm going to do a pretty thorough review of it I would imagine, for the show. So if you have any questions, do send them in. I'll happily work those into the review or just answer them on the show. That is it. I think that's all we have to say on the mailbag. We did have one other email from Charles, actually, who says, Ian and Nate, because every gentleman should have a shoehorn, I made my son one for Christmas, see attached. And he has indeed made him a shoehorn. It's a very attractive picture.
It's amazing.
And we had a number of people who have emailed us to say that they've bought or been bought shoehorns at Christmas as a direct result of our championing of the labour-saving device that we are such a fan of.
We are having an absolutely incredible impact on the shoehorn industry. I think that we should, if there's ever a, you know, a shoehorn marketing board and they do an advert, then you and I absolutely must front it.
Yeah, we'll be the Mitchell and Webb of the shoehorn,
yes,
Apple ad equivalent.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
I'm a shoehorn, I'm a hand. hey, tell me, hand, do you like having to be used in order to remove a shoe? That's probably run its course. Anyway, if you have any further thoughts on anything we've discussed today or may discuss tomorrow or indeed at any point in the future or past, you can do so on hello@techpodcast.uk. Now, let's check in with our good friend Tom Merritt over at Daily Tech News Show. Tom, do fill us in. What's been going on in the wider world of tech this week?
Hey, thanks so much. This week on DTNS, we learned why Nikkei will continue to report iPhone production cuts, but it probably doesn't mean actual iPhone production cuts. Ryan Shroud explained why cryptocurrency miners are sending GPU prices up and why you probably don't need to hold off buying a new PC just because of the whole Spectre meltdown thing. We also discussed the joys of renting things through the internet rather than owning them, the benefit of a stylus standard, and assess the dangers of machine learning that create fake videos. All that and more at dailytechnewsshow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, well, I think we're about done, Chief. We're about done. Thanks again to all of our patrons and to everyone who's started supporting us this year. In fact, I'm going to steal something that Tom says on his show. They try and every month try and have at least one more patron than the previous month, and they have more listeners than us, but I still like to think we could maybe have one more patron at the end of each month than the previous month. So if you've ever been thinking about joining us, maybe join us this month. Ian, we're done. I need to start editing a podcast, don't I?
Yes, this one, presumably.
Yes, indeed, this particular one. Cheerio.
Yes. Fantastic.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.